Thank you. Hi, everybody. My name is Tim Hyland. I'm an alcoholic. I've had the wonderful, beautiful gift of sobriety since April the 12th of 1990. And that's been absolutely, positively the best thing that's ever happened to me. And I'm so happy to be here. And what a wonderful event it's already been so far. Chandler, I'm so happy they gave you a big chair. Very nice. Colleague gave us a great talk today. You know, both of you all, I want to say this. You know, I've been around for a while. I'm getting a little bit older, and it's so great to see younger people come into Alcoholics Anonymous and carrying such a powerful message. And sometimes we worry about the future and how this thing's going to go, and you really give me hope that it's going to be all right, because I got a couple grandkids that need to be ready for them. And I want to thank Billy especially for inviting me. He's just a good friend and just does a great job in the service and putting things like this on. And I realize you guys are older people like me. This is getting to be about nap time. So you got to hang in there, all right? But like back in grade school, let's do some stretches now, boys and girls. Anyway, no, thank you for having me here. And, you know, I love Alcoholics Anonymous, you guys. No matter where I go, it's just so wonderful to walk into a room and just feel absolutely positively like you're in the right place. And that was never my case for my whole life. You know, today, you know, I don't know a lot of you by name, but I know you. You know, I can't explain that. People don't understand that. You know, at home sometimes they'll go, "Where are you going this weekend?" I go, "Well, Madison, Virginia." And they'll go, "Why?" That's a long story. Never mind. You never get it. But anyway, I love AA. You know, in particular, I'm very conscious of the world we're living in right now. You know, it's not real pretty. You know, if you look at it very hard, it's kind of scary, actually, what's going on out there. But, you know, I love Alcoholics Anonymous because we don't care about any of that, right? We don't care what color you are. We don't care what your religion is. We don't care what your political affiliation is. If you don't want to drink, you can show up here and you're welcome and we love you. And that's so beautiful, right? Because that doesn't happen too many spots out there in the world. And, you know, I like to share the story because it's so much, I think, what AA is all about. My home group is called the Lampton Group, and it's in downtown inner city Louisville, right? It's down in the hood. I mean, and as a direct result of where I've been for the last 34 years, many of the men that I sponsor are African-American or black men, you know, and I don't think a lot about it. That's where I grew up in AA, and that's just the way it was. Several years ago, I was down that way by my home group getting up on the expressway. And by that time, I got hit in the rear end, all right? And I got out, and it was an elderly black man hitting me and his wife. So we're standing in the middle of the street, right, waiting for the cops to come. And now keep in mind, I'm only about 3 blocks from my home group. About that time, we're waiting. Here comes 2 guys down the side of the street. They run over to me, both black. They go, "Tim, are you okay, buddy? Are you all right?" I go, "Yeah, guys, I'm all right. Don't worry about it." About that time, here come 2 guys from the other side of the street, both African-American, run over to me. "Are you hurt, Tim? Can we take you anywhere?" I said, "No, guys, go ahead." About that time, car comes off the expressway. 5 guys in there, all black. They stopped the car, jumped out. One guy hugs me and goes, "Are you all right, Tim?" "Guys, I'm all right. Go ahead." And, you know, I didn't think anything about it. I turned around. An elderly black man hit me with staring. Like, "Who are you anyway?" You know, what could I tell that guy, right? I'm just a drunk, you know? But what grows up amongst us is a fellowship that's indescribably wonderful, right? And it's such a special thing. And I don't want to ever, ever forget that. It's a real gift to be my age in this world and have the acceptability that we find in these rooms. My sponsor for 25 years passed away this past July. And I know a lot of you know him very well, Don Major. Now he's passed away from Louisville. I know he spent a lot of time over here in Virginia with Al and Billy and a lot of you. And Don was just such a special guy in my life for the last 25 years. But I tell you, early in my sobriety, he sent me down to Cherokee, North Carolina to speak at a Cherokee Indian Reservation AA conference. And I was so nervous, man. I'd never spoken outside of Louisville. And I'm driving down there to Cherokee, North Carolina and saying, "Oh, man, what am I going to say?" And of course, I get down there and I'm the only non-Native American speaker, right? I do not look like an Indian. I got up there to speak, and there's the chief sitting here, and there's the medicine man guy over here. And I'm like, oh my God. The next thing I hear myself saying is, hey, you all, you know, when I was a kid, I used to watch those Cowboys and Indians movies. Well, for the Indians, I swear I did. And the chief kind of started laughing. And I thought, I got him. And after I was done, the chief comes up and goes, hey, boy, we was kind of worried about you. When you got up there and told those lies, we knew you was in the right place. Oh, man. You know, I love laughing in Alcoholics Anonymous, right? You know, I'm going to share with you, if you're new, this, I always need to go back there, because when I was new, honestly, I would come to the meeting, I'd sit where you're sitting, and I would listen to what the speaker did that I didn't do. I was really all about that, right? And I'd listen to you, and I'd be sitting there thinking, well, I did that. Nope, did not do that. You know, next night, next speaker, did it. Nope, did not do that. I'm 3 weeks into this, and a lady of all things is speaking at this meeting. And I'm sitting there going, oh, man, everything she did, I did. I'm going, well, I did that, and I did that. I'm screwed. I did that, too. Then right at the end of her talk, she said she used to carry a half pint in her bra. I said, did not do that. Told this old guy about it after the meeting. He said, sound like you're getting a little desperate there to me, boy. And the deal was, I was trying to figure out what an alcoholic looked like. And you guys said, well, kind of like you. I said, no. You know what I mean? A dirty old man in a raincoat. And they said, no, we don't know what you mean. And that meeting that night, there were no dirty old men in raincoats. It's just like right now, Sam, there's not a raincoat in here. Dirty old men everywhere, but no raincoat. But here's what happened. The stories were all over the place, right? You listen to our stories in AA. But what caught me and still catches me is that as I listen to your stories, it seems like everybody was talking about the same three things. They were talking about being restless, irritable, and discontent. They were talking about being apart from, not a part of. They were talking about progressive patterns of dishonesty in their life. And I remember sitting there going, oh, man, if that's got anything to do with what's wrong with me, I'm in trouble. Because those three things have been part of my life from the get-go. Those three things I have fought with right in the middle of AA for the last 34 years, right? Restless, irritable, discontent, what is it? You know, book talks about it. I can't tell you what it is, but I can tell you I got it. I have had it for as long as I can remember, right? The one thing I always identify in AA, I say, hey, man, how you doing? They go, oh, no, man, I just got that stuff. You know, I said, I know. I know what you're talking about there, because when I was 14 years old and I put alcohol on that, it took it away, right? And as you've heard already this year, it was going to be my solution because, right, I was uncomfortable from the get-go. I didn't feel I fit in from the get-go. And I thought that God made this for stuff like, you know, this stuff for guys like me, right? Because it made everything right. It took everything from being crooked and made a straight line for me. You know, and I was decided that, you know, I was going to run with this as far as I could. Apart from, not a part of, you know, you hear a lot of us talking about that. I don't know what that is, but I'll tell you this, it is a part of what's wrong with me, all right? I'm 34 years sober. I've gotten to go around a lot and speak, but, you know, I'm flying into the airplane yesterday in the Dulles, and this little voice will go, Tim, they'll know you're not one of them. They'll know you're from Kentucky, buddy. And that little voice is trying to say, Tim, you're different. It always wants to tell me I'm different, you know, and that's the little piece that kills a lot of us, right? We can become just different enough. And one day you turn around and say, hey, what happened to the guy, Tim? He was a pretty good guy. And I know we were talking about that earlier today. We just disappear. You know, we don't make a big deal usually, but one day you turn around and say, hey, where did that guy go? We just kind of slowly back out the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous. And the last thing y'all were talking about was progressive patterns of dishonesty in your life. And that really hit me because what I knew for sure, that I had lied my whole life when the truth was good enough. You know, I lied when the truth was good enough, and I was very conscious of it. You know, when I was a kid, I was a pretty good athlete. So if I scored 20 points in the game and you came home, you'd say, how many points you score? I'd say 25. You know, got a B on the test. What'd you get? 10 B plus. You know, I would not hesitate and add to the truth. And I remember thinking, why do you do that? Why isn't the truth good enough for you, Tim? I got to Alcoholics Anonymous and I found out why the truth wasn't good enough for me. Because if you want to live the way you want to live, drink the way you wanted to drink, you couldn't live in the truth. And I got outside the truth very early in my teenage years. And one of the biggest things about coming into recovery was getting to my own truth so I could live with it, accept it, and live a decent life. I'll tell you a real quick story. I was 3 months sober. I was back with my wife at the time. She had taken me back. But I was sitting up at 12:45 in the morning with my 13-year-old daughter watching The Late Show. She couldn't sleep because she was 13. I couldn't sleep because I was 3 months sober. Right? So about 12:45, she says, "Dad, can I order a pizza?" I go, "Oh, honey, no, 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 don't do that. Your mother will go crazy." She said, "Oh, come on, let me." I said, "All right, go ahead." So she orders a pizza, 1:15 morning, doorbell rings, there's a pizza man. Here comes her mother flying out of the bedroom, screaming at my daughter, going, "What are you doing getting a pizza at 1:15 in the morning?" My daughter said, "Dad said I could." My wife said, "You say she could." I said, "Nope." My daughter said, "Dad, you're a liar." I said, "I know what I do it all the time." You know, and I say all that to say this: restless, irritable, discontent, apart from, not a part of, and progressive patterns of dishonesty in my life. And what I didn't know then, what I can tell you now, is what I was looking at was alcoholism and everything that goes with it, right? A disease of body, of mind, and of spirit. Right. And I had no idea. And I say that because the bottom line was going to be real clear to me. And I was very grateful for the people when I first came in that didn't pull any punches. They didn't say, "Hey, just put this jug, plug in the jug, sit down, shut up, and don't come to a meeting every day." They said, "You got to stop drinking or you don't even have a shot. But don't, please understand this. You got a disease that's much more serious than you think. You've got a disease of a crazy obsessive mind, and you've got a hole in your soul inside. And there's 12 steps, and there's a reason for all those 12 steps." And I say that because it took me a while to accept that. Right? It took me a while, and you've heard it here today with Chandler's story, and you're too young yet to have hit that second wall. But but we have to clean up that the rest of it. You know, those steps 4 through 9 become so, so critical. But anyway, I'll just share this with you. I grew up in an Irish Catholic family. Yeah. It wasn't if you were going to drink, it was when and how good were you going to do it, right? I mean, there was no question I was going to drink. I just wanted to do a little bit better than my ancestors were doing. And I always thought this, that alcohol actually worked for me before I ever tasted it. And what I mean is, I was the oldest of 7 kids, right? 10 years apart. It's the way those old Catholics did it back in those days, right? But I watched my daddy come in, and if he hadn't stopped at the tavern, I'd watch him, man. And he'd come in with that look on his face like he's going to kill us all. But then he'd reach up and get that Yellowstone whiskey and hit him a big old pop. Then he'd take a can of beer and just knock it back. He'd go, pop, 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 and hit him, go. And I'd be sitting there going, "Oh, that felt good." I mean, I'm watching his face going, "I don't know what just happened there, but I am in. I am in." Guy told me one time, "Tim, if you're catching a buzz at 10 years old watching people drink, probably going to have a problem." And I say that because our book very specifically says, I drank because I liked the effect of it. I don't care what else I told you all those years. It was very simple. It had an effect on me, okay, that I needed at that time. And the truth was, alcohol got me through my teenage years because I was a tall, goofy, grew too quick, fighting pimples, had to wear glasses, just awful. I mean, my teen years were awful. I couldn't talk to girls. I couldn't go to dances. The fear level was just so high until I could get a couple hits in me and the world was all right again. And I thought, I'm off and running and I'm going to run with this stuff. You know, I'll share this with you. I work with a lot of young guys today. And what I realized as I've gotten older, you know, is that I had hopes and dreams when I was a kid. I mean, I didn't want to grow up and be a drunk. You know, I didn't want to grow up being AA. Okay. In the state of Kentucky, some of you probably know this, if you can shoot a basketball through a hoop there, it's a big deal, right? So my whole life, the only thing I wanted to do was become a Division I college basketball player. And fortunately, God helped me out. I grew to be 6'4" and became pretty good at it. I became an all-city player, an all-state player in Kentucky. And my dream came true. You know, in 1966, I got a scholarship to St. Louis University, which at that time played in the same league with Louisville and Cincinnati and Drake, and there was a bunch of teams. So, you know, Division I, it couldn't get any better. My dream came true at 17 years old. And I was the first one to graduate to go to college in my family. So it was a big deal, right? With a lot of stuff in the paper about it. And so I was off and running. And I left Louisville to follow that dream in 1966. Alcohol and alcoholism jumped up in my life so quick by the first game of my sophomore year. In those days, you couldn't play as a freshman like you can now. But the first game of my sophomore year, I showed up to that game so drunk that the other players had to hide me down at the end of the bench so they wouldn't throw me out of school. So this is like going to watch your favorite team, whoever it is, UVA, and on the end of the bench, one of the kids is drunk. And I want to tell you what happened that day, because it was going to happen many times after this. I was walking down the street. The guy said, "Hey, you want to go get a drink?" And I said, "Well, yeah." I always said, "Yeah." As I had a mind that would say, "Okay, I'll go get a couple beers with you, come back, get a nap, take a shower, I'll go to the game, I'll probably be the hero." That's what my mind would do. I did at 18 years old, I didn't know anything about a physical allergy or a mental obsession. And I certainly didn't know anything about phenomenon and a craving. And if you'd have told me that the first drink was my problem at that time, I'd have told you were nuts. But the truth is, for the next 27 years, I tried to find out where the cutoff spot was. Where does the guy cut it off where the consequences don't come? I don't know about you all, I never found the cutoff spot. Got to Alcoholics Anonymous, I read the doctor's opinion. I went, "Oh my gosh, if this guy knows what he's talking about, maybe this explains a whole lot in my life. It may explain why I took a first drink and didn't make it to my little girl's Christmas play. It may explain why I promised my wife over and over again that I would be there for midnight mass and never show up. It might explain why I would tell you that I'll be there tomorrow morning to pick you up and I don't show up till 3 days later." Because all of a sudden I realized that maybe if this guy's right, that I have an allergy to this stuff, and when I take that first drink, I lose all control. It was my first hope that maybe I wasn't just bad. Because you know what? If you're always doing that type of stuff, what else can you think about is that you're just no good, Tim. You're just no good. You keep doing stuff over and over to hurt people. But when I read the doctor's opinion, I said, "Well, maybe I'm not bad. Maybe I'm sick. And if he's right, then if I don't take that first drink, maybe I have a shot," you know? And as simple as that sounded, it was such a revolution to me at that, a revelation for me at that time. You know, back to my college thing, I played the basketball through my junior year. I got hurt and I couldn't play my senior year. And, you know, and the sad part is I didn't care anymore. The thing I had worked my whole life, the most important thing in my life, alcohol went by it at 18 years old. And from 18 years old on, alcohol and alcoholism would dictate on a daily basis what I did, who I did it with, and especially where I ended up on any given day, right? It was driving the bus. Of course, the problem is I didn't know it was driving the bus, right? We don't know, we can tell looking back who took over, who was in control of our life. But of course, at that time, I think I am. But anyway, I couldn't play my senior year, so the partying really got going. But unfortunately, they said, "You got to graduate. You got to leave." And that was 1970. And my grades were terrible, but I had enough credits to graduate. Well, I didn't want to leave because I didn't have anywhere to go. In 1970, some of you are my age, you recognize this. There was a thing called the Vietnam War going on. It wasn't going great. Three of my buddies had already been brought home in body bags. And you had a thing called the draft lottery, right? Where they drew your birthday out of a hat to see when you got drafted. I was number 6 out of 365. I made the top 10. So, I'm going. You know, there's no ifs, ands, or buts. Now, I want to say this if you're a vet. I was going to go, you know, I wasn't brought up that way to run to Canada, you know, but it certainly wasn't high on my priority list. Let's put it like that. All right. Now, there were two ways in 1970 you could get out of the draft. You could get married. I thought, "Oh man, that's awful drastic there." Or you could go to grad school. Right. I thought, well, I only had one choice. I got to go to grad school. So I came up with a plan for the rest of my life at that time. Anybody ever do that? I came up with a plan that I'm sure God laughed his butt off at. And this was the plan. All right, here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to take that test to get into law school. I'm going to pass that test. I'm going to get into law school. I'm going to graduate from law school. Then someday I'm going to run for Congress and someday President of the United States. Short trip for me from street drunk to President of the United States. I can get there, you know. As a matter of fact, I was thinking, like, you know, it, I could, you know, I should be on a slate this year. I think I could do a better job than the guys I got. It's time to put a drunk in there, I think. You know? but anyway, I'm just trying to give you that idea how crazy my thinking was. Well, I took the LSAT. I got a terrible score on the test, and the law school turned me down. Now, here I am, 23 years old, a hero child, Mr. Allstate, Mr. Allstate, 4 short years. So I made it, so I decided, you know, one day it hits me, Tim, quit drinking, study for that test, and get into law school, because you got the brains. So for the next 5 weeks, I don't drink a drop. I go find this real smart guy down the hall, this real egghead, and he helped me every day to study for that law test, 5 weeks. And it was awful. You know, I had to get over the shakes, and then, you know, people were out there partying in the springtime. I'm in with this egghead studying this law test every day. 5 weeks, I gave it the best that I had, right? Came down to the day before the second test. Talk about the peculiar mental twist that precedes the first drink. I thought, you know what? I'm ready. I think if I go out and have a couple beers so I can relax, come back, get a good night's sleep, take the test, pass the test, get in law school, Congress, President of the United States. Same plan, one little upfront change if you paid attention to it. I left on Friday afternoon for those 2 beers. I didn't get back to that campus until the following Tuesday. Found out I rode around St. Louis on a city bus about a day and a half, when I know today is called a blackout. And honestly, you all, I did not know what a blackout was until I got the AA. I did know I used to start somewhere, end up somewhere else with a big old chunk of time gone. I didn't think a whole lot about it. And if you're new and that's happening, that is not right. Anyway, somewhere about 2 or 3 in the morning, I'm drunk. I know I'm not taking the test. So I go back to the dormitory, and I found the real smart guy who tutored me, right? And I paid him $20 to go take that test for me. And I'm not proud of that either, but, you know, that's where I was in my life. And in those days, you could do it a lot easier than you could do it today. So he goes and takes the test for me, and I stayed drunk for 3 weeks, or 3 days. I forgot he even took the test. About 2 weeks later, we got the results of the test the guy took in my name. Guy gets the highest score in the history of the law school. I remember opening the envelope going, "Oh, you idiot." He doubled the score I got on the first one. I go, and I knew I knew I'm in trouble, right? I said, I better get to them before they get to me. And I made the appointment to go see the dean of the law school. Now, here I am again, 23 years old. And this is where alcoholism are taking me. And I'm in this man's office, and he's sitting there looking at me. Never says a word the whole time I'm there. I'm saying, well, Dean, you're probably wondering about the difference in them 2 scores. I let some other guy take it. I didn't want to be a lawyer. And of course, I knew that he knew I was lying, right? But what I wanted to share with you, and I don't know why this happened, but when I walked out of that office that day, I knew the truth. It was crazy. It was like, Tim, you know the truth, buddy. It took the basketball out of your life, and it took your chance to go to law school, because you should be doing both of them, and you know it. And it's the booze. And I'm going to tell you, that lasted for about 15 seconds. Stepped outside that office. There were 2 guys that I know. They said, hey, you want to go get a drink? I said, yeah, I need a drink. This guy really screwed me over. That was 1970, you all. I didn't get here to 20 years later, to 1990. But I can tell you, as I look back on those 4 years, 4 and a half years, that alcohol and alcoholism took from me the very things I would fight you over the day. Took my dignity, took my integrity, took my self-trust, took my self-confidence. You know, it took that stuff I think we call moral fiber. And I think that's so, so important to me. I don't know, maybe to you, because I think every human being down deep, we want to feel secure. We want to feel confident in ourselves. And alcohol takes away, our disease takes away things. It takes our relationships, our money, our jobs, but it also takes that stuff. And the reason I know that, the last 34 years, you all have helped restore that, where I have a sense of purpose back in my life and a sense of dignity and confidence back in my life and security. And I thank you for that. So sometimes we call it morally bankrupt, whatever. So anyway, I snuck back to Louisville, crawled back to Louisville almost. And the only person who really knew what happened with the law thing was my mom, right? My mom kept the secret for years and years. And until I got to AA, nobody really knew what happened. I just told them I decided I didn't want to be a lawyer. And I missed you all at home, and I wanted to come home and be with you. and live with mom and dad. But anyway, and I took the draft physical when I get home, and I end up flunking the draft physical on a congenital birth defect, which I can't even get into, but it was the last thing in the world I thought I'd get deferred from the draft for. So, you know, God had a different plan. But anyway, when I came back, I was living with my mom and dad. I got into teaching and coaching, all right, because I played college basketball and I had a degree. So I got hired by this all-boys Catholic high school to be the dean of students at their school, which means they hired a drunk to be in charge of discipline at their school. My job, though, was to check all these teenage kids in every morning, right? And most mornings I'd be sitting there hungover, man, just trying to get to 9 o'clock, big old tomato head, you know, just trying. One morning I'm sitting there, and this is back in the 70s, right? And all the kids are out in the parking lot hitting a few doobies to get ready for class, right? I look up, this kid's got that long hair, had an army jacket on they wore back in those days. You could smell that reefer, and he was just floating over top of my head. And all of a sudden, he looked down, hey, Mr. Highland, you're looking bad, dude. I don't know, I can't remember what I told him, but I think it was something like, hey, I'm in charge here, bad guy. Reason I wanted to share that story with you, that kid who said that to me that day, this coming July, I think it'll be, we'll celebrate 38 years in Alcoholics Anonymous. He's pretty much a multimillionaire, lives down in Destin, Florida, and he's just a great member of AA. I went down there a couple of years ago and speaking, meets me at the airplane with his kids. And he comes running over and goes, hey, coach, come here. He said, look, I ain't never told my kids how I was. He said, I'll make you a deal. You don't say anything about me, I won't say anything about you. And, you know, one of the real gifts that I've had in sobriety, guess where a lot of those boys I tried to teach and coach in the 70s have showed up? Right in the middle of Alcoholics Anonymous, right? And I've got to sponsor some of the same guys I tried to teach and coach back in the day, right? And that's kind of been my experience, y'all. God's given me an opportunity to kind of redo all the areas of my life I trashed so badly. In fact, in the south end of Louisville, where the school is, invariably, if I go into an AA meeting, one of them will be there. And they'll jump up and go, ha ha, we knew you'd be here. And I go, yeah, I knew you'd be here too. But it's actually been a good ride for all of us. You know, it's just been a real, real blessing in my life. Also, when I tripped back into Louisville, you know, after the debacle, law school debacle, you know, I didn't know what I was going to do. I didn't have a job. I took the teaching job. But I had met my high school sweetheart when we were seniors in high school, right? We met about Christmas time, and we dated from Christmas till the end of the summer. And then I took off to St. Louis, and she stayed in Louisville. And then for the next 4 years, we had one of those on and off, love the one you're with type of relationships, right? But by the time I'm talking about now, after the law school debacle, I hadn't seen her for 8 or 9 months. I actually had been dating another girl from Chicago, and I had forgotten, I'd forgotten all about her, but I hadn't seen my original sweetheart. But I'm home with mom and dad, with nowhere to go. And I'm out one night, and I ran into my old high school girlfriend, and boy, did she look good. Oh, she looked so good, and I stopped to talk to her. She was driving this little yellow sports car. She told me about this great job she had, told me about this great apartment she was living in. I remember thinking, I think I'm falling in love here. That was in August of 1970. We got married in November of 1970. Didn't want to rush it. Let me take a drink before I get into this part. We got married in 1970, got divorced in 1983, we got remarried in 1985, got divorced again in 1987, but remarried in 1990. Right? Didn't jump the gun. Then we got divorced again in 1995. Oh, I know. I'll talk about that a little bit. You know, what's that all about, by the way? Well, I can tell you what it's all about today. It's all about alcohol, alcoholism, and everything that goes with it. I love him. I hate him. I hate him. I love him. He's good. He's bad. He's bad. He's good. If you don't know, there's a thing called alcoholism in the middle of any relationship. Pretty much an impossible deal, right? And that's why I have a big place in my heart for Al-Anon. Because if there ever was a family disease, this is it, right? Everybody around us gets really sick. And what you had there, actually, were two people who cared for each other, had no idea what we were dealing with, drunk or sober. But anyway, we had three beautiful kids in that marriage, however. Here's one. How about having your oldest son born on Christmas morning, right? What a gift from God that was, except I missed the gift. I was in the hospital that morning, but instead of being in the delivery room, I was in the men's men's bathroom with my head in a toilet bowl, spitting up whiskey, and all I could think about is I got to get out of here and I got to have a drink. You know, I missed the gift that morning. And not a Christmas goes by that I don't think of that morning, right? Because my Christmas baby, who will be 53, 54 years old this coming Christmas, he's been my toughest event. In fact, he has made it real hard on me, okay, for whatever reason. And I've really tried all through my sobriety to do what I can to add back to his life. And God gave me an opportunity because he has three beautiful little girls, right? He has a set of twins and another little bitty girl who have never seen me drink. And I will promise you this, he does love every moment that those little girls get to be with their pawpaws, you know? And a couple of years ago, and my oldest son is a typical child who grew up in an alcoholic home. Right? He has a hard time expressing himself. I don't think I ever heard him use the word love in his whole life. And he cornered me a couple Christmases ago and very awkwardly said, Dad, I do love you. But what I'm really grateful for, that my girls have never had to see you like I had to see you. You know, and I say that because sometimes we don't get the amends reaction that we want, okay? But a guy told me one time, you know, because when I came here, I don't know about you that has on this amend thing, I was like, hey, everybody, let's call it even. And nobody was interested in even. Yeah. My sponsor said, you know why? It's not even, you know? And then he said this. He said, Tim, you want credibility back in your life? I said, yes, I do. He said, here's how you're going to get it in AA, Tim. You're going to get it one day at a time by not drinking and doing the next right thing. That doesn't even sound good to me now. Wow, that's a slow boat there. It's so true. 34 years later, you know, I've established credibility with just about even my oldest son. You know, whether he likes it or not, he has a hard time expressing it. What he can't deny is that my life today is different, that my life today is lived for other people for the most part, that there's a new purpose and a new way about, you know, who I am. And I'll be forever grateful for that. You know, I did the teaching and coaching thing for a while, for actually 10 years. And I'll be really honest with you. I tell you funny stories about it, but the truth was, it was pretty sad, right? Showing up to PTA meetings drunk, showing up to parent-teacher conferences meeting drunk. I'd show up to parent-teacher conferences and some of the dads I'd seen in the bar earlier in the afternoon. You know? And I can't even imagine my kids and my grandkids for that happening to them today. Of course, they'd throw me right out of my ear. But that's where I was. And I was coaching. I was coaching high school basketball at a pretty high level, showing up drunk, coaching the games, and being told by the referee, I know you're drunk, you know, after he called a technical foul on me. And I'm going to let the school officials know if you don't shut up. You know, that's where I was. You know, drinking was just part of my life. I was going to drink no matter what, no matter what it took. But anyway, I also had this thing my whole life. I don't know if anybody can identify. I left the teaching and coaching thing. As I looked at it, it was for this reason. I've always had this thing where I will start to notice whether I'm working for you or I'm in a relationship with you or even in AA. I can start to notice I am not getting the respect that a man of my stature should be getting. And that was it. I noticed at that school I wasn't getting the respect a man of my stature should be getting, so I left. You know the good thing about AA? Nobody cares here. You guys said, Tim, we don't care. You know, if you don't feel respected here, then go to a different meeting or go to the bar. We'll be here when you get back. You know, we do not care. But anyway, I say that because that thing has also happened to me. Have you ever been in AA and thought, I'm not getting respect? The guy 34 years sober should be getting, you know? These young people are just not respecting me. It's almost natural for all of us, you know, because we have a disorder of the ego, as my sponsor Don used to talk about, that ego loves to be fed. And so as you get year after year after year, the ego tells you, you deserve something special, right? You're 34 years sober. This guy over here is 34 months sober, right? And hey, we don't care, right? We're both the same, you know, and that's the most incredible thing when you think about it. Because the thing that rang forth for me in the book that Don always talked about is I only have a daily reprieve based on the maintenance of my spiritual condition. which means I'm sober today as long as I can do the maintenance. And it's not about looking spiritual or being spiritual. It's about doing the dumb old things that you asked me to do in AA. Showing up to the dumb old meeting early. Giving the dumb old guy a ride home, right? Picking up the stupid old trash cans. And I say that because when I first got to AA, that's exactly how I thought about it, right? But I did it anyway. And as Don would always point out, he said, you know, Timmy, it doesn't matter how you feel or think or believe about it. As long as you do it, you'll probably stay sober. But I got such an ego, I'd like to feel good about it and be sober. And thank God, because over the last 34 years, you all, probably half the time, I thought, you all are the most wonderful people. I love all of you. I'm just so blessed to be here. The other half of the time, I'm thinking, you are the biggest bunch of hypocrites I've ever met. You're idiots. And, but as Don points out, is no matter what was going on up here, if you kept those feet moving, you stayed sober, didn't you, Tim? And so if you're new, you know, we know some days you don't want to be here. Some days you don't understand what's going on. But it'll work just fine, you know, if you continue to keep doing what you're doing. Anyway, I left the teaching and coaching thing. That was in 1980. And like every good drunk, you know, you got to start your own business, right, sooner or later. And I started my insurance business. We just got to do it. It's our thing. And I started my insurance agency in 1980. Okay, I got sober in 90, right? The 80s were not a good decade. I already told you I got divorced in 83, remarried in 85, divorced in 87, remarried in 90. I was engaged to two other women in between time. I was in a nut house five different times. I was in three major car accidents. I lived 12 different places. I had 12 different business partners. I got shot at twice, and I got stabbed with a beer bottle, and I lost $250,000. And I was thinking, this is going okay. We're always the last to know, man. I don't know what that's all about. From 1982 to 1985, I went through five psychiatrists. And I look back, that was really simple. I kept them until they started talking about alcohol. They talked about alcohol, fired them, got me a new guy. You know, I was drinking whiskey and took every antidepressant they ever made in the 80s. You know, and if you're using that recipe, it didn't work real great for me, right? New Year's Eve, 1985, back at mom and dad's again, right? I used to run into guys I went to high school with. They'd say, hey, man, what are you doing now? I said, well, I'm president of the wrong company. They said, no kidding, where are you living? I said, mom and dad. But anyway, New Year's Eve, 1985, you know, it's one of those days that no matter how much I drank that day, the thrill was gone. That's the best way I can put it. And that was the day I realized that my buddy, friend, alcohol that I had found at 14 years old was never, ever going to work the way I thought it would have worked all those years. And that's a scary moment, right? You can't live with it and you can't live without it. And my brother Tommy drove me over to Our Lady of Peace, which is our asylum up on the hill over there in Louisville, Kentucky. And they checked me in. And I'm going to share this with you because this is my alcoholism in a bucket. I was as suicidal as I've ever been, but I didn't know what to do with me. You know how that is. So I go in there and I sit down. The lady said, go back in that little room. So I got to go back in there and sit. And this nurse comes in and sits next to me. And she says to me, well, honey, tell me about it. I said, okay, I'll tell you about it. Well, 2 years ago, my first wife threw me out for no reason that I can think of. And then I got engaged to this other girl. And gosh darn it, she took off the ring and I didn't even pay for it. And, oh, yeah, did I tell you my daddy went to prison when I was 12? I don't know where this stuff was coming from, right? But the more I shared, the better I felt, right? Maybe they're an iron. This lady looks at me and goes, well, honey, you certainly have a right to feel the way you do. I thought, God, lady, you are so right. What was I thinking? If people messed over you like they messed over me, by God, you'd be drunk too. I was cured. I hadn't even been there an hour. Because I just figured it out. It wasn't me at all. It was you guys. It was you guys, and if I just hung around the right people, this would all be okay. I spent the next 16 days in that hospital helping everybody else. Really, I thought God sent me there on a mission or something. You know? I had a drunken old minister who was my roommate. I was helping him out. They made me head of the stress class. I got a blue ribbon for the best ceramic in the shop. You know? I was killing it in there. I came out and I did what I always did. Well, I started over. Got back with my most frequent wife, as I call her. Got a new business partner, got a new place to live, got a new car, and we really tried hard. We even bought a new home, right? Tried to change everything we could, and then the old timers kept saying, Tim, wherever you go, and there you are, buddy. The drunk was still in the middle of the room, and she threw me out late in 1989. And I spent the last 6 months of my drinking living in the guy's basement in the south end of Louisville. And can't tell you anything miraculous happened there. I can tell you this. April 12th of 1990, I went out that night like I always did, and I came in about 3 in the morning. The family I was staying with was already asleep, obviously. I remember sitting on the edge of the bed, drinking the last 3 beers he had in his refrigerator, and watching ESPN go off the air. That tells you how long ago it was. And then I had this craziest feeling I've ever had. I got all creepy, just, you know, sweating. And I thought, my God, maybe I'm having a heart attack. Maybe I'm taking myself to the emergency room. But then I passed out. All right. Passed out in my clothes. I woke up about 5 in the morning, had that same crazy feeling. Took a deep breath and got up to head to the shower. And about halfway to the shower, I just collapsed on the floor. And the clarity hit me. It was, Tim, you've lost everything again. You've lost your home again. You've lost your wife again. You've lost your kids again. And your business is about to go down in bankruptcy. And I just sat down on that floor and said, God, I do not know what to do. I don't know what to do. And I got up, took the shower, and I went into my office. And by that time in my insurance business, it was a very busy place, right? Phone rings all day. People in and out of the office all day. April 12th of 1990, I sit down at 8:15 in the morning. Sat there until noon, 4 hours and 15 minutes. The phone never rang one time, and nobody came in the office during those 4 hours. And, you know, our book talks about a moment of clarity, and I don't know if that was it for me, but I can tell you this. Something happened in those 4 hours, and the only way I can describe it to you was I kept feeling it was over. It was over. I didn't know what was over, but that was the overriding feeling. And I reached in my desk drawer. There was a meeting directory of Alcoholics Anonymous, which a guy had given me 2.5 years before, right? And that was on a Thursday afternoon. And I went to my first meeting. And I'll tell you, from that day till this afternoon, you all, the last 34 plus years, I have to tell you, man, to be honest with you, it's been quite the journey. I've been up and down, all around. I've laughed harder sometimes than I've ever laughed. But I've also cried more tears than I thought a guy like me would ever cry, right? And I felt pain and sorrow and grief like I didn't think I could handle. And the reason I say that, when I was new in here, I was thinking, boy, I really hope the sobriety thing is about the absence of problems in little Timmy's life. And you all said, oh, little Timmy, who told you that? They said, little Timmy, here's what sobriety is about. You're going to get to be part of life, Tim. And Tim, you're going to get to be there in body, in mind, and in soul. And the bell went off because my wife used to say to me back in the day, Tim, you're not even here when you're here. And I would get mad. I'd say, I'm sitting right in the chair. Can't you see me? And then I read our book, and our book talked about this very specifically. It said, Tim, your disease is really this. You were either drinking, thinking about drinking, or thinking about yourself. That's alcoholism at the max. Everybody out. And I realized that even when I didn't have the booze in me, I had an obsession of mind, an obsession of self that blocked me from a lot of people in my life that I really cared about. As a direct result of that, I lost my marriage at 5 years sober, and I'll talk about that a little bit. And Chandler talked about it a lot. You know, sooner or later, this real part of our disease, the inability to live in a world with some comfort, if you really haven't done the work to do that and get to the core of where that really that lies in our step process, you may not drink, but you may have a whole lot of consequences in your life. You know, and it took me at 5 years sober to lose my marriage and some other consequences that came down the road, excuse me. But anyway, and when I got to the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I had just a wonderful sponsor, I couldn't have a better sponsor, right? But what I've also learned is there's something about us in Alcoholics Anonymous where we got to get our own experience, right? Yeah, I know that might have happened for you, Al, but I'm a little different, you know. I'm sure I can escape out of that part, you know. And early on, the same way. You know, if the normal person has to do a meeting every day and all 12 steps, and I should be able to get by with a couple meetings a week and 6 steps. I mean, you know, that was the mentality I had, and unfortunately, a lot of us have. So I had to take some bumps, as I always do, to get ready enough to take the next step as I moved along those step processes. I was in the rooms one day, and my life was such a mess, right? And I was moaning and groaning about it at this meeting. This old guy says, see me after the meeting. I said, all right. He said, what are you whining about? I said, well, oh, man, everything's a mess. I'm wife divorced me. I'm losing my business. I don't know what to do. He said, sit down. I want to see you. Tell me about your business, Tim. I said, what do you want to know? He said, just tell me about it. I said, okay. I said, it opens at 8 o'clock. He said, good. Be there at 8 o'clock. Not 8:05, Tim, not 8:10. Be there at 8 o'clock. What's next? I said, well, I'll go on sales calls. He said, good, Tim, go on sales calls. What's next? I said, well, I'll go to lunch. He said, good, Tim, go to lunch. And Tim, come back from lunch. That's a good point there. And what's next? I said, I've got to come back in and do my paperwork. He said, what's next? I said, well, I'll go home at 4:45. He said, good. Go home, have dinner with your family. Go to your meeting, come home, say your prayers. And then he hit me with a big one. He said, Tim, do the same thing the next day. I was like, oh my God. Like you do that every day. What a concept. You know, and what he was telling me, y'all recognize this piece. Don later gave it a name. He was telling me, and Don said, Timmy, what he's telling you is your job to do the stitches and leave the patterns up to God. Timmy, you just do the stitches, the little bitty things that are in front of you every day. And we promise you that God's got the pattern. But see, that was hard for me. I would start thinking stitching, huh? Okay, what am I making here? Is it a hat? Is it a shirt? Is it pants? And when's it going to be done? I said, no. You just stitch, as stupid as it may seem, and trust that God's got the pattern. So I started doing it every day, getting there at 8, going on sales calls, going to lunch, coming by. It was boring, you know, but I kept doing it. And I'm 6 months into this, and I look at my bank account one day. I still owe $249,270. I'm thinking, this is a slow boat here. I'm not getting anywhere. But I kept doing it. Here's the sequel to the story. 6 years later, I come into my office one day. There's 4 or 5 phone messages. They're all AA guys except for one, all right? So I call my AA guys, and the one it wasn't was a local business reporter from our business paper in Louisville. This lady calls me and she said, Mr. Highland, we'd like to do an article on your business as one of the fastest growing of its kind in the Louisville area. I said, well, gosh, thank you. I'm very honored. I said, that's great. I said, what is it you'd like to know? She said, sir, what was it that you did that really turned your business around? And I had a great story. I did. I said, I came up with this great idea, pulled myself up on my bootstraps and rocketed this company. I said, nah, ma'am, here's the deal. My office opens at 8. And I went late through the whole thing, right? And at the end, there was like silence on the other end of the phone. She goes, thank you, sir. We'll see what we can do. And you guys, I knew there wasn't going to be an article. But I knew I told her the truth. You know, Don always would tell me, Timmy, just get up each day and ask God, what's the next stitch in my personal life? What's the next stitch in my AA life? What's the next stitch in my business life? You know what? It's always there. It's always a simple little thing, but it doesn't seem important enough to me. I'm a big deal guy, right? I like big deals. And these simple little things just didn't seem like they were going to get me anywhere. But when I can do that and stay in the stitch, as Don would always talk about, and be there right here, right now, it's the happiest, the most peaceful that I can ever be. You know, I'll share this with you. We laugh a lot in Alcoholics Anonymous about our poor record in relationships. And I don't know that we're any worse than anybody else. Yeah, we are. We're a lot worse than most people. But, you know, none of that was funny, obviously, when it's happened, right? We laugh about it today. But when you lose your marriage when you're drinking, it's one thing. When you lose it sober, whoa, it was really painful stuff, right? And, you know, but I would come to the old timers when it would happen in AA, and they'd say, well, Timmy, just keep helping drunks, son. Just keep helping drunks, right? And I have to say that. That's the one thing I've consistently and persistently done my whole life, right? I've kept a drunk in front of me. And so our book tells us that, is that when all else fails, keep a drunk in front of you. And you might be crazy in the loon, but you'll stay sober. And I did do that. But so anyway, after that divorce of 5 years sober, which, by the way, you know, I can tell you today I lost because of my own selfish and self-centeredness, which wasn't the story initially. You know, initially when I lost that marriage, if you'd ask me, well, what happened to your marriage? I go, well, I would tell people, oh, it's sad. Real sad. She was in Al-Anon, I was in AA, and then she quit going to Al-Anon. And I was in AA just growing spiritually like a weed. And we just grew apart. Yeah, that was so much BS, right? Truth was, I wasn't drinking, but I was still self-centered. I was still thinking about me and what was going on with me. And I couldn't be there for her as a husband. I couldn't be there as a father. But anyway, so after the divorce, I kept helping drunks. And so I helped drunks 1 year, then I helped drunks the second year. I get into the third year, and I thought, man, God, I don't mind helping drunks, but boy, I'd certainly like a partner to help drunks with if you don't mind. Oh, man, it was a miracle. Boom, there she was, right in the middle of Alcoholics Anonymous. Incredible. She was 5 years more sober than me. She was in the middle of AA. I was in the middle of AA. We did the mandatory 3 months and got married. We had a big AA wedding. Her sponsor was there. My sponsor was there. I was singing Bill Wilson's Looking Down Gold. That's a good one there. Yeah. The marriage lasted 8 months. Now I'm almost 2 years sober, and it went down in flames in the middle of Alcoholics Anonymous. And it was painful and embarrassing, hurtful for both of us. And I'll tell you right off the top, she's a good AA, and we have made amends to each other, and actually in pretty good shape today. But then it was horrific. Right? It was really horrific. And I thought I'd really hit a bottom like no other bottom I had. But now I'm on my knees asking God, what is so wrong with me? What is so broken with me that I can't have a decent relationship? And I come to you guys, and the old guy said, oh, Timmy, we don't know, but keep helping drunks. Keep helping drunks. And I did that. But I'll share this with you. A strange thing happened to me on my way to long-term celibacy in Alcoholics Anonymous. I was back after that divorce living with my mom and dad. Again. And a couple things, though. You know, God does work in strange and mysterious ways. The last place in the world I wanted to end up was back in my dad's house, because he and I always had friction. I was the oldest child, and I was always in between my mom and him. He had a drinking problem. And so when I got sober, he wasn't too much in favor of that, right? It kind of was intimidating to him because he wanted to keep his drinking going. So anyway, after the divorce, I could go live with my dad. Oh, gosh. A strange thing happens to my dad. You know, dad had a stroke, just a minor stroke where it kind of messed his face up a little bit. But you know what happened? He forgot that he drank. He forgot that he drank. And he was a heavy drinker. I was a dangerous thing. So sometimes God works in strange and mysterious ways. But anyway, I came home on a Thursday to fly to Texas to speak at a conference down there. And I walked into my bedroom, and my dad had washed all my clothes. He had ironed them. He had them all stacked up there. He had my suitcase there. I'm like, what is this? And I turned around, and my dad was standing in the doorway. And he looked at me and said, Timmy, I know where you're going. You're going to one of them A&A meetings, aren't you? I said, yes, sir. And he got tears in his eyes. He said, I just want you to know how proud I am of you, that you got sober. And I wish I could have got sober at your age. My life would have been so much better. And we cried and we hugged. And here's what I'm going to tell you. You know, my dad died 2 months later. But if I hadn't had the divorce, I would have never ended up back in my dad's house. So the worst thing I thought had ever happened in my life turned into something that God used in a very healing way. And I say that because sometimes a little lady heard me speak one time. She said, Tim, it sounds like you always came to periods in your life. So yeah, I came to a lot of periods. She said, I'm going to tell you something. God doesn't use periods. He only uses commas. Only uses commas. And if you think you're in a period in your life right now, you're wrong. There's a comma there. The problem is he didn't tell us what's behind the comma, right? That we have to suit up and show up and, you know, continue to help God's kids and continue to see what he's got in store with us. But anyway, I'm back at my dad's, and also I get a call from my mother and my children. Remember her, my most frequent wife? She's down in South Carolina with the kids and the grandkids, and I guess she heard about my debacle again. And says she felt sorry for me, and she called and said, hey, would you like to come down here to South Carolina, spend some time with the kids? I said, yeah, I'd like to get out of Louisville. And I drove down there, got a separate condo from where they were staying. Now, here you all, here are two people. We've known each other since we were 17 years old. Been married and divorced three times at 50 years old. And for some reason, the walls were just too high. The walls would not come down. That weekend, for some reason I'll never understand, there was more of a peace about it all, okay? We actually agreed to work on a friendship, because we never did that. We actually agreed to work on being parents and co-parents. And those walls didn't seem quite as high you know, when we were down there. And I came back to Louisville, and I came back, and I started to date her. We never really dated a lot. We just married quite a bit. And, I would take her out every Friday night, you know, and we worked on a friendship, and we really got to know each other at 50 years old, 52 years old, and so we did that for about 6 months, and then we're sitting there one night, and I looked at her, and she looked at me. I said, "Hey, what do you think?" This past, let's see, what are we, 2024, this upcoming 24 would be our 54th gross wedding anniversary. Not sure what the net is, but they're gross is 54 years. And I said it would have been because, as some of you probably know, very unsuspectingly, my wife was struck with a very rare form of melanoma cancer in August of 2022, and she died in October of 2022. Very, very short. But I share this with you. You know, as crazy as that whole story was, the last 20 years we had were beautiful. I mean, we couldn't have been any closer. We couldn't have been better friends. In fact, I used to often think, what was the problem anyway? And I said to Don one day, I said, "Don, is this crazy?" He goes, "Well, Timmy, it might be crazy. I don't know." He said, "But Timmy, maybe not." He said, "You know why? Because if our program's about anything, it's about transformation. And you know the thing about transformation? We don't know when it's going to happen. We don't know how it's going to look. And we don't know who's going to be involved. You know why? We don't transform. God does. You know, my friend Bob in Minneapolis talks about we plant the seed, we water it, we keep the weeds away from it, but we don't grow it. God grows it when he wants to grow it. And you all, that has to be what happened here. Somewhere in all that calamity, God transformed two people who could finally come together and love each other for the last 20 years of their life. You know, and I'll be forever, ever grateful for that. Didn't see it coming. And as I look back, the only thing I did to contribute to that was stay on the fire line, right? I kept showing up and suiting up and keeping a drunk in front of me, which doesn't seem like that's going to heal anything, does it? But somewhere in that process, God was doing some work on both her and me so we could have that wonderful, wonderful relationship. And I'll finish up with this. You know, I told you we talked about the periods and the commas. And so when she died in October 22, then I lost Don last July. You know, big hits in my life, right? Two of the most important people that I've known my whole life were gone. And I'm thinking, well, it's over. I'm done. You know, stick a fork in me. You know, I'll be 76 years old in June. You know, I'll just ride this thing out, help a few newcomers here and there, and just take it on into the barn, Tim. And again, a strange thing happened on my way to that period in time, you know. But here's an interesting story. So I get a call from a lady who used to work for me, and she had a substance abuse problem. I was thinking of you a lot. She was great, but she couldn't stay sober. And she stole from me, actually. She stole from our company. And I didn't have to, I had a prosecutor. But she's out and about. And she, every once in a while, she would call me. She wants to get sober, right? So after my wife had died, she called me one day and said, "Alan, will you meet me? I want to get sober." And I said, "All right, well, meet me at this breakfast place we had down the street, and I'll help you try to get started." So I show up down there, and as you might guess, she didn't show. You know, and I'm used to that. You know, I mean, drunks just don't do what they say they're going to do. But I go up to the register to check out, and I see a lady there who I kind of know. And the reason I kind of knew her is that I knew her back when we were teenagers, and also knew her husband had died just 3 months before my wife had. And her husband had 28 years sober in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I saw her, and I said, "Hey, can I talk to you about a few things, about hospice and things like that?" And we have had a beautiful, beautiful friendship. You know, we have such a great connection because there's so many things in our life that we've experienced the same way. You know, and so we're enjoying that, right? I didn't see it coming. She didn't see it coming. But, you know, we spend some time together. She's a very spiritual lady. You know, she really works her spiritual side of things, which has been really nice. And so once again, right, I didn't understand that God always has something there for us, you know, if we just stay willing, you know, if we just stay willing. I had three kids in that relation in my marriage. I told you that. I had two sons, and then I had my baby girl. And my baby girl was her daddy's daughter all the way, right? But she was a little toddler. Her first little phrase was, "I'll do it myself." Her second little phrase was, "Is you're not the boss to me." And I knew, I said, oh boy, here we go. By the time she was 12 years old, I'm finding half pints in her backpack. I'm finding six packs in the closet. I'm getting her out of jail all over town for shoplifting. Game's on, right? Beautiful child, by the way. Talented child. By far my most talented child. All right, great volleyball player, great tennis player, great artist. I mean, whatever she seemed to want to do, she could do. But what she liked to do most was drink, right? And she was really hard at it, tall, blonde, blue-eyed, gorgeous. Then she left Louisville, got a scholarship to the Art Institute in Chicago, right, on her art. And that's where she was for the first couple of years, and deep into her drinking, I knew that. And she got bored with the Art Institute, so she got into the Second City, okay, which is a performing arts thing that they had there with John Belushi and those guys all went through, right? She got bored with that, and then I knew by that time she was heavy, heavy into her drinking, and she took off to L.A., you know, to join the Second City out in Los Angeles, just in a car with her and her dog. And we lost total touch with her, but I didn't know enough people in L.A. to know that she was living in her car with her dog on a liquid diet. And one of the problems with this also, in addition to her alcoholism and drinking, she had an eating disorder, really a bad combination, right? Because all she was doing basically was drinking alcohol, and her body was basically consuming itself. It starts to happen after a while. So I guess about 22 years ago was now, she came home to Louisville. We hadn't seen her in 2 years, and I have to tell you, I'll never forget the vision. And here's my beautiful blonde blue-eyed girl. Her teeth were all caving, falling out. Her cheeks were collapsed. Her eyes were all back in her head. You know, she was so thin, you could count her ribs through a t-shirt. And I remember saying to her, "Honey, look, if there's anything we can do to help you, let us know." And I remember her snapping back at me with those alcoholic eyes and said, "Dad, if I ever need help, I'll be sure to call you. Bye." She got in the car, took off back to L.A. And I knew at that time, you know, I was 12 years sober, and I knew at that time it's only a matter of time, right, when I'm going to get called. But she couldn't continue to live like that. I mean, she truly was dying physically. About 5 weeks later, I got a call. And the good news is it was her. The bad news is she was so weak, she was whispering. And she whispers to me, "Dad, I don't know what to do. What should I do?" Now, I'm 12 years sober at the time, I'm telling you, and I help a lot of guys. I have never, ever had any trouble telling somebody what the next step is and what we do. But with your baby girl, she's 3,000 miles away, I want to tell you one thing, man. It was a whole different deal. Because I'm asking myself, well, Tim, what do you think about the A&A now, buddy? Is it good enough for her? What do you think about those 12 steps you're always popping off about? Is it good enough for your little girl? And here was the big one. Tim, what do you think about that guy you so think so much of? Is it good enough for your baby? And, you know, it wasn't. If you're a daddy, all I can think about is I'm going to get on an airplane, go out and get my kid. That's what I'm going to do. And I hung up that phone. No, I didn't hang up the phone. But before I hung up the phone, I said, "Honey, I don't know where this came from. Here's a man's phone number in Alcoholics Anonymous out there in Los Angeles. I pray and hope you will call him and ask him for help." And I clicked, I hung up. And I tell you all, I sat there for 2 hours crying and sobbing because I thought, what did I just do? Did I just kill my kid? Did it just kill your only daughter, Tim? What are you thinking? But the longer I sit there, okay, what came to me is what we hear all the time anywhere, anytime, anywhere, that somebody shows up wanting the hand of AA always has to be there, okay? And what I came to feel and understand was by giving her that phone number, I had extended the hand of Alcoholics Anonymous. Whether or not she was going to grab it and do something with it now was between her and her God. But I want to tell you, it was hard, right? It was really hard. And I say that because I know a lot of you have been in that situation or you will be in that situation. But I didn't know after being here for even those 12 years that this is a God thing. And all human power had failed us. And she was either going to have her moment and reach out like I had reached out on April 12th of 1990, or she was not. And I'm very happy, happy, happy to tell you, in the last July, her mom and I were able to fly out there and help her celebrate, you know, her 21st anniversary in Alcoholics Anonymous, right? and she's doing great out there. She's sponsoring a lot of women, helping a lot of women, and I'll be forever grateful. And I'll just finish with this, because this is the deal, right? While we are here, the man's phone number I gave her, and some of you will remember this guy, and he's passed away now. His name was Scott Redman. And the reason I mention this is I think Scott was probably 26 years sober at the time. He died of pancreatic cancer probably 7 or 8 years ago. I never thought about it a lot, but all of a sudden it hit me. She called him that night, and he could have easily said, well, honey, look, I'm busy, and I'll have some lady call you in the morning, or, honey, look, go to this particular meeting, and I'll see you. He didn't do that. For some reason, he said, where are you, and where can I get to you? And I'm convinced, hadn't he done that night, I'd have a whole different story. She was that sick, right? And he went and got her. And he introduced her to Alcoholics Anonymous in California. And as a direct result of that, I'll be forever grateful. And it reminds me that I hope we can remind all of us that sometime, someday, we're all going to get that type of call. And I hope that I'll be like Scott. And not say, no, I can't get out tonight, it's too cold, or no, I'm in the middle of watching my show. I hope I'll realize that if she didn't need help, she wouldn't have called. And then what AA asked me to do was to suit up and to show up and reach out to that person. And that's what we do, right? And I try to say yes, just like you said today, Colleen, no matter where I'm asked, to come here, go everywhere. Because I always remember that night, that man said yes, and if he hadn't said yes, I don't think I'd have a daughter today. So we're blessed, you know, to have each other. We're blessed to be in a program where the whole counts. It's just not all about us individually anymore. It's about what we can do to help the next person. And again, I want to thank you all for having me here. Billy, thank you. It's been a wonderful. Tim and Colleen, thank you for Ross Talk. I'm Tim, and I'm an alcoholic.